compliant corporate media and repeated by leading politicians who take their cues from Tel Aviv. But the cold-blooded, calculating and callous reality is very different to the media and political spin. As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeym University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is investigative journalist Patrick Henningsen, who joins us via Skype from Arizona. As well as being an investigative journalist, Patrick is also an author and the founder of the independent news and analysis website 21st Century Wire. 21st Century Wire digs behind the headlines to provide listeners with a better insight into world events. Welcome to the show. David, there's been a constant process of revision, hasn't there, about what actually happened on October the 7th?
There certainly has. I mean, first of all, we heard the totals of casualties, 1,400, sometimes more. And then what's happened is that there's been various different eyewitnesses. Some of them have been people who turned up later after it happened. Some who've been released by the resistance movement. Yasmin Porat, in particular, was one of the ones who says, first of all, that what happened was that the IDF, the occupation forces, had themselves killed some of the hostages. And then, of course, that we learned later that many of the hostages were killed in fires caused by the shelling from tanks of houses in which the hostages were held. So we have the origin story of all this Hamas burnt people actually appears to be tank shells which have put houses on fire and killed all of the occupants. So there's been a constant process by the high level of propaganda, the babies being beheaded, people being women being raped, the burnings, all of this stuff has fallen away and now appears to have been simply invented by Israel.
Indeed. Well, Patrick, I mean, what's your view on the changing contours of Israeli Hasbara, or otherwise known as propaganda?
It's really interesting. They got off to an incredible fast start, lightning speed from the beginning. You could see how the narratives were being shaped. Also, the rhetorical inversion and some of these tactics have been deployed. I mean, my first impressions was that the propaganda, the sort of stories that were being pushed out as the sort of the lead emotive stories were very sloppy. They were evidence-free. There seemed to be little effort put into even trying to do a good fabrication of a story. So the fake news was kind of clumsy in a way, but is very effective because everybody basically, you know, fed that into all mainstream media disseminated throughout the Western media. So you had the beheaded babies, you had the burnt, charred body of a baby or some image that was put out, the allegations of mass rape, the intentional targeting of civilians, and the music festival, allegedly 260 people allegedly killed by Hamas. So those are the main pillars of the outrage that was used really to justify the Israeli response and the American total support, unwavering support, the British unwavering support. Everybody from all these countries and governments basically repeated all of these, basically fake talking points and used that to drum up public support behind Israel, or at least government support. As we know, the public around the world are slightly different than governments and media now on this issue. But the latest one, even this week, a baby was put in the oven. This was quickly debunked in the last 24 hours. So elderly being raped. I mean, so the image of Hamas was just a marauding, rampaging ISIS conclave, and so this idea to equate Hamas with ISIS, I think that was definitely an objective. And there's a reason for this. It's really important to understand. This had to be framed as a war on terror narrative, because suspend. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely, absolutely. But David, I mean, what do we now think then actually happened during the resistance incursion?
Well, we know that that the incursion was not expected, despite what has been said about the Egyptian government warning the Israelis. It wasn't expected. It wasn't something which Israel had allowed to happen. That's a story which is going around of the blogosphere, and it's completely wrong. It was a daring and audacious raid. I mean, in the air, from the sea, on land. And when the resistance fighters, remember, not just Hamas, Hamas, of course. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, even the lesser known group, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, seen involved in taking control of occupation force bases.
Yeah.
But I think what happened was that in the end, the resistance forces were surprised by how successful they were. They had a mission plan, but they were surprised at how successful they were. And then it took a long time for the occupation forces to beat them back. People think then, oh, that's the end of that. The resistance has been defeated. Not a bit of it. I mean, we've seen several incursions north and indeed to the east of Gaza by sea and by land since then. And that's an ongoing process. So what we're seeing here is the idea that the resistance is easily defeatable by Israel is false and continues to be false.
Sure, yeah. Well, David, Patrick, nearly all the eyewitness accounts of the Al-Aqsa flood operation pretty much undermine the Zionist version of the story, as David was just saying. I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of exculpatory evidence, most of which has been omitted by the Western media, but has appeared in the Israeli media. So this really shatters the image of the IDF as this kind of, great fighting force. What you see is incompetent, a lack of coherent intelligence. They're reckless. They panicked. They used their own Israeli civilians as human shields, even using them to draw fire from Palestinian resistance forces. So that was a lot of these videos have been seen now. Eyewitness testimonies have been seen. So this shatters the whole narrative of October 7th. And the other thing is the warrior nation. You know, this is one of Israel's biggest selling points. This was also shattered as well,
yeah,
as the victim nation too. So all these things have been destroyed really in the last 3 weeks.
Let me just go to David then. Just tell us, David, about the evolution of this sort of Hannibal directive.
Well, I like the idea that it's named after the Carthaginian general who poisoned himself rather than be captured.
Yes.
That is, of course, the essence of what was called the Hannibal Protocol when it was first invented in the 1980s. It became the directive when it was revised. I think let's focus on the revision.
Yeah.
Benny Gantz revised it to introduce, this is lovely, an ethical principle.
Yeah.
And the ethical principle is it's all right to kill your own side,
yeah,
so long as you kill some of the other side as well. That's,
yeah,
that's the level of Zionist ethics.
Yeah.
It's, murder is okay of your own side as long as you murder some of the other ones as well, the natives.
Yeah.
And you see here the guy, for the 95-year-old recruit for the IDF who's talked about wiping Hamas,
yes,
and indeed the Palestinian women and children off the face of the earth. This is a guy who was, of course, a Lehi fighter, a Stern Gang fighter back in the 1940s, appears to have been involved in the Deir Yassin massacre,
yes,
indicating and underlining the fact that Zionism has always been a genocidal ideology,
yes,
from the very beginning, and it's no different today.
Yes, 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 indeed. Well, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after this exposing horrifying Zionist hate speech.
Although they spend a lot of time and resources pretending that they're Democrats and not racist, Zionists are often, especially in a crisis situation, very clear about what they believe. We see settlers on the streets of occupied Palestine chanting, "May your village burn," calling for a second Nakba and for death to the Arabs. Racist and genocidal statements are everywhere, including at the very top of the Zionist movement. What follows with minimal commentary is Zionist in their own words.
I'm very puzzled by the constant concern which the world and also Britain, I must say, Mark, is showing for the Palestinian people and is actually showing for these horrible, inhuman animals who have done the worst atrocities that this century has seen.
Israel needs to increase humanitarian pressure on the Gaza Strip so that eventually hundreds of thousands of hungry and thirsty Gazans will break through the Rafah crossing. If we were dealing with humans, we'd send humanitarian aid, but we're dealing with animals.
You have to be very careful, because let me tell you, we're going to finish this war. We're going to win because we're stronger. After this, Russia will pay the price. Believe me, Russia will pay the price. Russia is supporting the enemies of Israel. Russia is supporting Nazi people who want to commit genocide on us, and just Russia will pay the price.
Israel is not at war with human beings. We are at war with monsters.
This is not Auschwitz. This is Hamas. We are not fighting against humans. We're all fighting monsters. Israel will not stop until Hamas is destroyed. Hamas savages.
It's an entire nation out there that is responsible. It's not true. This rhetoric about civilians not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true.
Right now, one goal, Nakba. A Nakba that will overshadow the Nakba of 48. Nakba in Gaza and Nakba to anyone who dares to join. Zionism is a racist and genocidal ideology. It must be eradicated.
David, I mean, that's a catalogue, isn't it, of horrifying statements there. But it's not unique, it's not new, is it?
Well, look, these statements that we've just heard, I mean, as you say, horrifying. This one from Arsen Ostrovsky, who works for one of the Zionist troll farms with Palestinians as cockroaches. This is pure fascist propaganda, as everybody who has any familiar with Nazi propaganda knows. And these statements have all been made in the last month, you know, since October the 7th. I mean, this is a huge quantity of genocidal, openly genocidal statements made by key Zionist ideologues and significant figures in the movement, not just ordinary settlers on the streets, as we've also seen in the film. But yes, of course, this is what Zionism is. Zionism has to be genocidal. Mm-hmm. It has to find a way, in order to establish a Jewish state where Jews will have more rights than anybody else, Christians or Muslims or anybody else, it has to get rid of the natives. And of course, they got rid of 750,000 in 1948, yeah. And killed many as well. And what they've got to do to complete the project is to get rid of all the rest of the Palestinians. That's why we've seen these secret plans emerging,
yes,
about relocation of the 2.2 million population of Gaza into the desert in Sinai. And the Zionists have very generously promised that of the ones who they don't kill and they manage to force out, they'll provide them with some tents to live in.
No, indeed.
I mean, it's
indeed
truly, truly awful. But this is what Zionism has always been, and it cannot be anything else. There is no way of Zionism being an ideology which can live with the Palestinians.
No, indeed. I mean, the think tank report that I saw took effectively a final solution for the Palestinian people.
They have the word final in there.
In Gaza, yes. I mean, it's truly shocking. But, Patrick, I mean, you've written, haven't you, that Netanyahu has unleashed the Zionist equivalent of ISIS, fanatical, messianic, far-right Jewish settlers who want to ethnically cleanse the native Palestinian population. I mean, to what extent is this an irreducible problem of Zionism, do you think?
Well, you know, this is a problem that's always existed. Having just spoken this week to residents in the West Bank, they told us this has always been a problem. The only difference is now the IDF, or police force that used to restrain the radical far-right ethno-nationalist armed settlers that would, you know, intermittently attack or threaten Palestinian residents in the West Bank, now they've been let off the leash after October 7th. And so this is really dangerous. And if you couple this with Netanyahu's own invocation of, you know, Old Testament scriptures like the Book of Samuel, that we must smite the people of Amalek and, you know, kill their infants, their livestock, leave no one alive. It's really dangerous because this precludes really to have a real diplomatic discussion at any point in the future. So he's harnessing all of the worst fanatical elements. So you have radical nationalism combined with fanatical religious messianic themes, and it's completely a toxic cocktail. And how do you walk that back? How do you walk that back?
No, absolutely. But David, I mean, it really seems as if the mask has slipped, doesn't it, with these statements? I mean, do you think that's true?
Absolutely. I mean, they still make the occasional nod to international law. So Isaac Herzog, the president, making such a statement to the press the other day, but his mask slipped as well, talking about there being no civilians in yeah. Gaza, and that effectively women and children are legitimate targets for their operations. They're not actually even really pretending to attack Hamas, as they call the resistance, different resistance factions. So, yes, the mask has slipped. But what we see, though, of course, when the mask slips like this is that millions of people across the world see for the first time, in addition to the already large numbers of millions who know perfectly well what Zionism is, the world as a whole, the population of the world, is united against Zionism. It's only those countries, the leadership of those countries, in some of them in the G7, but especially the US and the UK, who support and prop up the Zionist entity. We've seen just recently, in the last few hours, I've seen stuff about the Ministry of Defence's D-Notice Committee trying to pressure the media in this country, not to mention the fact that the SAS are in Cyprus and the military bases in Cyprus, British military bases in Cyprus, and potentially already in the Gaza envelope, involved directly in the genocide. So we see, you know, unsurprisingly, the direct involvement of the US and of course the UK in what is a clear genocide.
No, indeed. But there's a real disconnect, isn't there, between the political class and the corporate media, even in these Western countries. You know, with where the general public is at, as we've seen with the massive rallies in on the streets of London and towns and cities up and down the land, and indeed across Europe and in the United States as well. But Patrick, I mean, what shocked you most, would you say, with these statements that we've just heard?
I think it's just the fact that they feel they have the license to sort of be open about it. And, you know, what they did at the United Nations with the Israeli representative there, and they're all pinning yellow stars to the lapels in protest of any other countries that are demanding a ceasefire. So asking for a ceasefire, according to the Israeli delegation, is tantamount to promoting a Holocaust, which is the complete opposite of reality. It is the most bizarre, strange thing that's unfolding, and I really think they're so marinated in their own propaganda, as are Western governments, that they've really lost touch with reality, and they just have completely overdone it. They've over-egged the pudding, as they say, and I'm quite shocked, actually, at how this has unfolded.
Well, I think many people couldn't fail to be shocked by that clip that we heard there. But, David, did you get a sense that the mainstream media, the corporate media, is beginning to be, you know, a bit more critical now of the genocide that's unfolding before our very eyes?
Well, look, many, many millions of us are seeing a huge torrent of images of dead, dying children, babies being pulled from the rubble. And people who see that, you know, they can't help but be moved by that. The mainstream journalists see these things as well. They don't put them on the shows, but they see these things as well. And I was watching, for example, Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel's press conference. Even CNN journalists and the ITV journalists were asking them reasonably critical questions. And even more recently than that, there have been some signs in the mainstream media of proper analysis, the beginnings of a proper analysis of what's actually happening. So you can see that people, journalists on the ground, they know what's happening.
Yeah.
It's just that they're not allowed to put out what's really happening on pain of being removed, as, of course, Jeremy Bowen was removed by the BBC.
Of course. Yeah. No, indeed. Briefly, Patrick, because we're almost out of time, but I mean, but do you think the US and Israel can get away with just continuing the bombing without significant pushback?
Yeah, I think they can, and this is a deliberate strategy by the Israelis, which is to prevent any media from coming in, cutting off power and communications, keeping the UN investigators to come in. As you know, there's almost 50 UN workers, medical and otherwise, that have been killed so far in the Israeli carpet bombing of the Gaza Strip. So UN's mandated to send investigators in. They have to, but they can't. So the minute that happens, everything ceases and people can see what the real story is. That's what they want to prevent.
No, indeed. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time again. So let me thank our guest, Patrick Henningsen, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. Until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics.
All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For the people of Gaza, it is genocide. For weapons companies, it is an opportunity to test new products. Weapons makers treat genocide as a business opportunity, as they have done in decades in different corners of the world. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, publications read by arms industries managers and their clients are trying to note each item that makes its debut on the battlefield. An all-terrain vehicle with light reconnaissance capabilities and designed for special force units in the Zionist regime's military has been spotted, according to one such magazine. Mortar munition called Iron Sting is being unveiled. Even the Zionist regime's Navy newest missile ships are getting a slice of the action. It should be patently obvious that the weapons industry profits enormously from war and oppression. While decent people around the world are protesting against the massacre in Gaza, some analysts are speculating about which weapons the Zionist regime will use next. Amid such obscenity, Jens Stoltenberg, NATO's Secretary General, recently complained about the misguided idea that the defense industry is somehow unethical. Everything is unethical about the war industry, but NATO, which actively promotes higher spending on weapons, would never admit that, nor would this military alliance own up to how it facilitated the genocide now being perpetrated in Gaza. On October 12th, the Zionist regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, addressed his NATO counterparts via a video link. Just 3 days earlier, Gallant had resorted to Nazi language by calling Gaza's peoples human animals. There is no indication that NATO expressed revulsion or even mild unease at that term. Rather, Stoltenberg assured Gallant that Israel does not stand alone. NATO was sending similar signals to the Zionist regime before the latest war against Gaza was declared. In late September, Rob Boer, the Dutch admiral chairing NATO's military committee, visited the occupied territories to hang out with the top brass in its army. Boer was given a tour of Erez, the checkpoint from which the Zionist regime has overseen its blockade of Gaza. Boer had previously welcomed the Zionist regime's representatives to NATO's Brussels headquarters in May. On that occasion, he discussed the innovation strategy followed by the Zionist regime's military and its development of disruptive technologies. The limited details published by NATO did not specify which technologies may have been singled out. Yet, it is certainly true that the Zionist regime is now disrupting all aspects of life in Gaza and, to a considerable degree, across historic Palestine. NATO celebrates how its cooperation with the Zionist regime stretches over a period of almost 30 years. The cooperation is sufficiently intense for NATO representatives to describe the Zionist regime as one of its like-minded partners. To prove that they are like-minded, some of NATO's leading players are abetting the genocidal war against Gaza. The U.S. is the worst culprit. It is flying weapons to the occupied territories nearly every day. Boeing is among the American companies profiting from the genocide on Palestinians in Gaza. The smart bombs, which Boeing manufactures, theoretically can minimize civilian casualties. It is apparent that the Zionist regime is slaughtering civilians in vast numbers on purpose. Members of the ruling coalition are not hiding that fact. Galit Distel Atbarian, the Zionist regime's public diplomacy minister, until recently, has recommended erasing all of Gaza from the face of the earth. Britain, meanwhile, is headed by Rishi Sunak, a prime minister who fervently hopes the Zionist regime will win its genocidal war. Although Sunak has been blunt about his backing for the Israeli regime, the British authorities want to keep some elements of that support under wraps. Gag orders, known as denotices, have been issued to newspapers following reports that Britain's Special Air Services, SAS, was primed to assist the Zionist regime's war efforts. France may be taking a slightly less obnoxious line that Britain, by voting in favor of a UN resolution urging an immediate humanitarian truce, but that was after Emmanuel Macron, the president, sought to legitimize the Zionist regime's absurd claims that it is fighting an enemy worse than ISIS. NATO is a club which nominally promotes democracy and freedom. In reality, it is aiding the obliteration of Gaza. According to Al Jazeera English, Palestinian officials reported that 18,000 tons of bombs have been dropped on Gaza. The destruction on the ground is consistent with this figure. Almost all bombs dropped belong to the United States designed MK-80 family, which has been in service since the Vietnam War. Originally designed as conventional free-fall weapons or DOM bombs, they have been constantly modernized with sophisticated targeting devices that have converted them into smart bombs. These bombs are made in various sizes classified by total weight of the weapon: 120 kilograms, 250 kilograms, 500 kilograms, and 1,000 kilograms. The Zionist regime Air Force uses three main types of fixed-wing aircraft, all U.S.-made. The F-15 fighter jet's main role is to secure aerial superiority, although some also can be used as bombers. The Zionist regime ordered 75 of the latest F-13 fighter bombers and has received about 40 so far.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
جنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم
النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة وصيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin was salatu was salamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are focusing currently on the 31st letter of Imam Ali alayhi salam that was addressed to his son Imam Hassan alayhi salam, which has some very important pieces of advice, especially for managers and people who have any position of authority and guidance towards others. We reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَأَمِتْهُ بِالزَّهَادَ, that kill your heart through asceticism, through abstention, through renunciation, for example, limiting your attachment to this world, through not being attached to this world, basically. So you kill this heart by not being attached to the world, by not allowing it to be attached to the world. Now, the thing is, Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying, kill the heart. Now, this is where we need to focus. What does it mean that Imam Ali alayhi salam saying, kill the heart? Inshallah, we shall discuss about this in this session.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about a certain important issue here for managers. And that is, he says that, وَأَمِتْهُ بِالزَّهَادَ, that kill the heart through what we can call as not being attached to the world. Now, why is Imam Ali alayhi salam saying kill the heart? Well, the heart is a good thing. The heart is basically that center of all the beautiful, wonderful, feelings and those inclinations towards spirituality and all of those positive things. And we need the heart to be alive. That's why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, make it alive in the previous statement. He says, make it alive through preaching and advice. But then he's saying, kill it through zahada, through not being attached to the world. Here, Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about a certain aspect of the heart, which is the aspect of the desires and the anger that lies in the heart. Now, see, anger and desires are both positive faculties. And that is why they are part of the heart. I mean, the heart is a positive thing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us. Now, okay, it's a whole discussion about, understanding the human being and what the heart means here. Of course, it's not the physical pumping heart that we're talking about here. We're talking about an aspect of the soul, which we call the heart. Some people refer to it as the nafs, or they refer to it as the soul. Whatever the case, we are speaking about that center of perception, of spirituality, of connecting with God, of love, of positive feelings, of and also of sadness and happiness, all of those things that happen in the heart in general. So Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying, kill it through the process of zuhud, through asceticism, through not being attached to the world. When he says that, what does it mean? He means that kill the anger and the desires. Does that mean we should not have any desires and we should delete them from our system? Or we should not have any anger? Of course not. What he means by killing this aspect of the heart, it means that it should not have control over you. It should not have a certain level of independence where it can do harm to you. Rather, you should control it as if it's under you completely. It should not have any form of independence in itself. You should have complete control over it and use it in the positive way.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that kill the heart through abstention, through asceticism, through zuhud, or what we call lack of attachment to the world. Here, Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to say that, look, if you want to completely kill that aspect, those aspects of desires and anger that can make you do the wrong things, then you need to have something called zuhud, which is called lack of attachment to the world. That means you should use the world and make use of those desires and the anger, but in the positive way, and don't be attached to them. The problem is, for example, some people get attached to those desires, certain desires. And because they get attached to those desires control them. They do not control those desires. The desires end up controlling them. They do not control anger. Anger controls them. But when you control the anger, when you control your desires, you in reality have killed them. And you have become alive in reality. You have become alive and you have killed them. Not that they don't exist, but their authority is under you. It's as if they are dead. And it is you that is actually there controlling them and giving them energy and giving them life and driving them in the right direction. Such that now a person who has control over these desires is such that whenever a situation of haram or unlawful desires comes across him, he doesn't pay attention to them at all, as if he's dead. People will say, are you dead? You're not going towards this thing, this haram thing. Are you dead? He says, yes, my desires are dead. They're under my control. Okay. Or for example, someone comes and slaps you suddenly. Right? You control yourself. If just a normal person who doesn't have control over his anger, he will slap that other person back. But one who is controlled will first think about it and see what is the next step to be taken. This is what we call that the desires and angers are under you. They are dead. Or this is how we say the negative aspects of the heart. Not the negative aspects as such, from the context you understood, that those positive things that can be misused are now controlled in a way that they are only used in a positive sense. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه
كبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine activists have gathered at a railway station in the British capital London, calling for an immediate end to Israel's atrocities in the besieged Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. UK's Labour Party leader has come under mounting pressure to back a ceasefire in Gaza as the Israeli regime military continue to relentlessly pound the besieged Palestinian territory. Despite increasing calls from inside the Labour Party for an end to Israeli hostilities against Palestinians, the Labour leader Keir Starmer on Tuesday, 31st of October, resonated remarks made earlier by the Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu by saying, "Now is not the time for a ceasefire in Gaza." On Wednesday, 1st of November, in a clear revolt against Keir Starmer's remarks, hundreds of Labour councillors joined a growing international campaign for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip by signing a letter to the Labour leader, urging the party's head to back a Gaza ceasefire. In the letter, at least 330 Labour councillors asked Keir Starmer to unequivocally condemn the brutality of the apartheid Zionist regime forces against civilians trapped in the blockaded Gaza Strip under heavy non-stop fire, cut off from water, food, medicine and power supplies. The letter said, "The intensified human catastrophe in Gaza impacts all of us, and the Labour Party's failure to call for an end to violence is causing hurt in our communities." Speaking at the Chatham House Foreign Affairs think tank in London on Tuesday, 31st of October, Labour leader Keir Starmer said, "While I understand calls for a ceasefire at this stage, I do not believe that it is correct position now." Keir Starmer insisted he took collective responsibility, the principle that members of his front bench team adopt a unified position, seriously, but he gave no indication he was about to sack those who had spoken out against him. He said, "It is for me to address collective responsibility. I recognise that." He claimed a ceasefire would freeze the conflict, allowing Hamas to launch attacks against Israel again in the future. Keir Starmer's remarks resonated with that of hawkish leader of the apartheid Zionist regime, Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu declared on television, "Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas, and that will not happen." Benjamin Netanyahu insisted, "Israel will fight until this battle is won," indicating that a total siege, airstrikes and shelling of the Gaza Strip will continue until the resistance of all the Palestinians in the occupied lands is completely crushed by the occupation. We'll be right back. The website of Socialist Worker has also covered the same story and tells us more. Pro-Palestine activists have gathered at a railway station in the British capital London, calling for an immediate end to Israel's brutal airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip. More than 500 demonstrators staged a sit-in protest at London's Liverpool Street station during rush hour on Tuesday, 31st of October, waving Palestinian flags and chanting slogans such as "Palestine will be free" and "Ceasefire now," as commuters tried to make their way through the crowds of protesters. According to their social media posts on X, formerly known as Twitter, videos posted online by the human rights group, which organized the sit-in, showed a large group of demonstrators filling the station. The rights group said hundreds of commuters joined the mass action, saying they have shut down the station. Members of other activist groups, such as the Palestinian Youth Movement and International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, also joined the pro-Palestine protest, calling for an end to international support for Israel's actions in Palestine and an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. British Transport Police said in a statement that they attended Liverpool Street Station following reports of a protest on the station concourse. The statement said, "British Transport Police officers worked to safely disperse the crowd and ensure passengers could access the station." Over the past 3 weeks, pro-Palestine demonstrators have packed the streets of central London several times, condemning the British government's unequivocal support for the Israeli regime, demanding an end to Western funding of Israel and cessation of Israeli aggression in Gaza. Despite government attempts to delegitimize it, support for Palestinians is on the rise, with hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets of central London to raise awareness of what's happening in Gaza and to express solidarity with the Palestinians. The latest development comes as people in Western countries, including those whose governments have expressed staunch support for the Israeli regime, are holding similar solidarity rallies against Israel's brutal war in Gaza, denouncing Western support for the regime in Tel Aviv. The Middle East Monitor has also covered the same story and tells us more. The International Centre of Justice for Palestinians has warned British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak of its intention to prosecute him and other officials over complicity in the Israeli regime's war crimes in the Gaza Strip. The International Centre of Justice for Palestinians, a UK-based independent organisation that works to promote and support Palestinian rights, recently issued a notice to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak over the United Kingdom providing military, economic and political support to Israel, which has aided Israel's perpetration of war crimes in Gaza. The International Centre of Justice for Palestinians notice comes as the Israeli regime made attempts to forcefully evacuate more than 1 million Palestinians in northern Gaza to the southern parts of the territory. The International Centre of Justice for Palestinians said the mass forced displacement may amount to both a war crime and a crime against humanity. It added, the siege of Gaza, restricting electricity, food, water and other basic necessities, constitutes collective punishment of the population, which is also a war crime under the Geneva Convention. It added, now that war crimes have been carried out, continuation of such support and assistance would mean the British government officials would be complicit in the committing of war crimes and potentially crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip. The International Centre of Justice for Palestinians said the complicity, formerly known as aiding and abetting war crimes, may mean that the British government officials are individually criminally liable for breaking international laws.
Economic Divide.
If there was ever a cause that united people around the world, the Palestinian cause has just done that. Israel's war on Gaza has opened the eyes of the world to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians, and of course, the U.S. all-out support. And now it's time that the world realizes how Israel has strangled the Palestinian economy on a daily basis, including that of Gaza. This is while its own economy is now tanking. Hi, I'm Kaveh Tafwai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program: the Israeli occupation. Gaza and West Bank economies are controlled. Water, electricity, natural resources, including in that, and that's prevented Palestinian economic advancements. Next, we take a look at Israeli control, another one of the highlights, which is large in scope. The Gaza siege, 17 years. You have the occupied Palestinian territories, where imports, workforce participation, and Palestinian products are restricted in more ways than one. We will be taking a look at that. Then Israel's siege. Iran has called at the OIC meeting a call for sanctioning Israel. That points somewhat to a BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction in terms of a reboot. And is there an international will to boycott Israel? As the crisis continues across the occupied Palestinian territories, their concerns are further economic crisis in the occupied West Bank. Since the Israeli military occupied the West Bank, it has deployed a matrix of policies and practices that seeks to control the people of the occupied Palestinian territory. Israeli policies and practices have fragmented the territorial and economic landscape of the West Bank. Its tactics have eroded the productive capacity of the occupied Palestinian territory, depriving it from its growth potential. The occupied Palestinian territories continue to be chronically dependent on donor funding for its fiscal survival. The Palestinian economy remains extremely fragile, structurally weak, and highly dependent on Israel for trade, wage employment, and the provision of basic infrastructure. That has already lost its viability and fiscal sustainability. The Israeli regime controls the borders, airspace, population registry, and economic activity of the Palestinian territories. Israeli military orders, assigns quotas, and a permit system which restricts a Palestinian access to and the development of water resources. Given the continued and ever-evolving restrictive context, Palestinian policymakers are left with limited choices as to ways in which to slow down the ongoing deterioration of socioeconomic conditions.
We've lived in the Jordan Valley in the Humsa area for decades. Livestock is our livelihood. Before the announcement of the deal, the occupation used to demolish homes, cut off the water, burn land. The occupation army used to chase us. We suffer a lot from the occupation, especially during their military training.
Time now to take a look at some of the online posts. We try to bring in all sides of the story into this, namely Israel's economy on occupied land, and then the Palestinian economy in the occupied territories, and of course the economy of Gaza. All right, first up, we saw this particular entry on a number of sites, including Twitter, known as X now. Israeli political crisis could cut 2.8% a year from the GDP based on a warning by the central bank. Looking deeper into it, where we went into the website, it said that exports, consumption, and investment could be hit if the row over judicial reforms are not as resolved. Added, the judicial changes would affect Israel's risk premium, exports, consumption, and investment. And then finally, the hit to GDP would be anywhere between 0.8% and 2.8% per year on average for the next 3 years. Ouch, that's got to hurt. Next, Palestine. What challenges does the Palestinian economy face? This entry said, given the sharp decline in aid, which fell from 27% of GDP in 2008 to 1.8% in 2021, the Palestinian Authority has accumulated a large arrear to the private sector, the pension fund, and domestic borrowing. Underlining that part about how aid is 27% of Palestine's GDP, which is now down to 1.8%. That's quite a large contribution, and of course the drop, that is very drastic. Anyways, let's find out what our guests think. That's more important. First segment of our Q&A, Rabia Billings Natuna joins us. She is a pro-Palestinian and human rights activist. Rabia Billings Natuna, welcome to Economic Divide. First question is about the occupation, both in Gaza and the OPT, Occupied Palestinian Territories. The economic consequences have been devastating, the Gaza Strip especially, things like water or controlling the material that comes in. How did that and the siege impact Gaza's economy, which in part was a driving factor perhaps behind what has occurred?
Okay, so my take is before we can delve into the economic factors, we have to realize that we can't look at the situation in a vacuum. We have to focus on, like, most resistance movements, like even in South Africa, starts with the basic denial of human rights. And what has happened in Gaza and the rest of Palestine is, and we've seen it, and the escalation of violence, which ultimately has seen 2023 as being the deadliest year for Palestinians. And it's everything. It's Israeli security forces who has perpetuated the widespread attacks on Palestinians, which also involved or included aerial bombardments. These aerial bombardments leave destruction on a massive scale. We've seen it this week as well. The Israeli military border police forces are killing Palestinian children. Palestinians are regularly subjected to violence by Israeli settlers, which includes things like physical attacks, shooting, with live ammunition.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Let me bring in Blaine Coleman now. Blaine Coleman is a BDS activist and campaigner who joins us. Blaine Coleman, welcome to Economic Divide. In the occupied territories, in particular, obviously, I'm talking about the West Bank here, there's a lot of Israeli control that it exerts over the Palestinian economic activity, with things like imports, workforce participation, for example, or the availability of Palestinian products on the market. We're trying to get an idea from you, if we can, the type of control and how much of it is exercised on the Palestinians, which makes life very hard for them.
Well, it's extraordinarily severe and cruel, this control that Israel exercises over the West Bank. For example, Israel has split the West Bank into hundreds of ghettos, sealed off from each other by hundreds of military checkpoints and roadblocks, supplemented by armed and dangerous settlers roaming the main roads. And so, in the best of times, before this horrible assault on Gaza, life was like that in the West Bank. Now you've got these Israeli settlers driving Palestinians physically out of huge areas of the West Bank with a lot of violence. Now, the exact economic impact, if you want that, between 2000 and 2020, it has cost Palestinians $50 billion. $50 billion in the occupied West Bank is a lot of money.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English.